So welcome to this, which is week 7 and lecture 6 on the history of the BBC. We're somewhere in 1964. This is a continual process of the BBC, just like other broadcasters, trying to find new kinds of programme. We often ask the question, do they give the people what they want? Sometimes this is possible. Sometimes you know what people want and you can give it them. But quite often, you are inventing. You're hoping people want this. I gave the example last week. If you went around London in 1957 and you said, would you like an hour every week, a program about astronomy? Well, most people would say, oh, I don't know. A lot of people would say, oh, no. And some people would say yes. And in fact, the program about astronomy got several million viewers every week. So inventing audiences, this is the real skill of broadcasting, to try to imagine what people will want and not react to what people do want. And in every case, even the programs which are closed down after a couple of years, they will often get millions of viewers. Of course, The Sky at Night, the astronomy program, continued for 50 years. Now, it only continues for 50 years because it has millions and millions of viewers. Yeah, otherwise, even if they like it, the management after 2 or 3 years, yeah, we like it. Half a million viewers, I'm sorry. Even though we think, you know, half a million, yeah, that's quite a lot of people. It's got to work in millions. So in the 1960s, they are inventing ways of football. And this was perhaps quite an easy one. Because what they decided to do is every Saturday afternoon, they would have one football match on the television, and it continued until 2023. Every time it says 2021, it's ended there. Now, this was perhaps not a very difficult decision. Yeah, the British people are mad about football, and so they were fairly safe. Yeah, every Saturday afternoon we'll have a football. That was an easy one. But sport is an area where sometimes the BBC has had a very specific public service role. For example, in the 60s, in Manchester, say, a normal town, some people played football. A lot of people played football. A few people played rugby. Some people played cricket. Girls played netball. And that was about it. And the BBC worked very hard at putting on the television minority sports. You know, athletics or rock climbing or kayaking. And that we found that after 20 years later, the number of sports you can choose from if you're a teenager or a young adult in Manchester is much bigger. There are dozens and dozens of different sports. That is, that part of the public service of the BBC was to encourage a wider variety of experience for ordinary people. And this was something that, in general, commercial television was not so interested in. Because commercial television, will there be 10 million viewers or not? Whereas the BBC considered that encouraging minority tastes was important. Now, this is, of course, a matter of opinion, but many people in the BBC thought that public service means giving more choice to the citizen. Not just false choices, now I don't want to caricature, but sometimes the choices we get, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. Oh, thank you for the choice. Yeah. Do you prefer Coca-Cola or is Pepsi-Cola okay?
Both,
there you go. It doesn't really matter if you have a choice or not, I think, for most people. Whereas, you know, in other questions, it can be quite important. Hey, you brought that in as a special to help me with my prop. Okay, so before I get onto that, I have some new things to say. In October 1965, they began a new programme for Asian immigrants on Sunday morning. Television and radio on Sunday morning on the BBC for Asian immigrants. These were programmes which were partly in English and partly in Punjabi, Gujarati, Hindi and other languages from the Indian subcontinent. First of all, just to remind you about the vocabulary, if you are in the United States and somebody talks about Asian Americans, they're probably Vietnamese, Cambodian, something like that. But in Britain, when people say Asians, they mean India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. It's just because those were the big groups who came. So very often in a translation, the word Asian translates into French as Indo-Pakistani. Because Asiatico, so fair affair. So this is obviously a public service to do these programs which help immigrants with their daily lives. So it might be how to register for a doctor, yeah, how to understand the tax system in Britain, how to find friends who speak Punjabi or Gujarati, I don't know. But these were programs for immigrants on a Sunday morning, interestingly enough. Now, this is part of the history of Britain, which in the last 70 years, the history of multicultural, well, in general, the history of the British Empire has been central to the history of Britain. First of all, abroad, decolonization, and in Britain, multiculturalism, which still has, there's still large numbers of problems and lots of racism and lots of, not a problem, but a lot of anti-racism and lots of things going on. But this is an important strand, and the BBC could not avoid an important strand in British history. In fact, every big social change will also affect the BBC, because it's talking to millions of people every day, and so it will affect them. But this one is a particular example, perhaps, having programmes on the television in Punjab and Gujarati, of the influence of multiculturalism in Britain. Remember that multiculturalism is not just diversity ethnique. Multiculturalism is the idea that different cultures in the same town are a good thing and should be encouraged. That's multiculturalism. And ism is an ideology, yeah, like socialism, feminism, multiculturalism. It's an idea, and it says that different cultures is a good thing and should be encouraged. And this is a particular, this has been particularly important in British history. So, for example, if you go to a school in London, they seem to be always having a festival, because they will have celebrations for Christmas, celebrations for Eid, celebrations for the Hindi Festival of Lights. Yeah, any religious festival, all of them are now in French. You have the opposite option: no religious festivals celebrated in schools. And in Britain, we say, "Well, let's celebrate all of them." It's a huge difference, and certainly even today, in other areas than the BBC, this is particularly notable. If I go to my mother's hometown and I go into the municipal library, I will see 5,000 books in English, 500 books in Gujarati, 500 books in Punjab, 500 books in Hindi, and this is automatic. Whereas this can happen in France, but it's not typical in a municipal library in France. It's a different. In France, there's been more emphasis on the idea that, you know, French is central. So these new programs on a Sunday morning were part of a strand of multiculturalism which we'll be going for. On the slide, you can see another couple of plays from 1965. This was part of the series of the Wednesday play, which considered that you could write fairly serious theatre entertainment, but quite serious entertainment, and that you could get millions of people to watch it. And in this case, it's a matter of a couple of plays by Dennis Potter. The first one, called Stand Up Nigel Barton, follows the hero, Nigel Barton, from his childhood as a son of a miner, and how he came to end up with a scholarship for Oxford University. The second play, which is called Vote, Vote, Vote for Nigel Barton, shows how he becomes Labour Party candidate for the elections for Parliament. And so they try to show life inside the Labour Party, life in a working class town. Now, the play is generally sympathetic to the Labour Party, but it's not intended to be political propaganda. It's about helping people understand how Labour Party people works. So you can imagine that certainly Labour Party supporters would like it, but quite a number of open-minded Conservative Party supporters would also like it, because it helps them to understand. Now, the following year, 1967, saw a couple of political changes, not connected to the BBC, that I need to mention because they're important in the change in mores and general socio-psychological atmosphere. In 1967, the Sexual Offences Act was a new law which made homosexuality legal between men in private. Before 1967, it was illegal to be homosexual. The situation was horrific in the early 1970s, that homosexuals had to always burn the letters after they read them. Never keep phone numbers, because if the police came to get you, then they would take all your phone numbers and get your friends too. The suicide rate was very, very high because the pressure was just so great. It was a horrific, horrific situation. And so 1967, this was the end of that, and if you were over 21, homosexuality was legal. Also the same year, abortion became legal before 24 weeks. So these are two big changes. This is the Labour government, 1964 to 70. And although they did not make the huge and expensive changes they made in 1945, free hospitals, free doctors, free dentists, social housing, nevertheless, in the 1970s, they made these important social changes. But we can learn something about the atmosphere in the country at the time by the way they made the changes. In 1966, there was a general election. The Labour Party did not say, "We will legalise homosexuality. We will legalise abortion. Vote for us." They kept completely quiet about these questions because they thought that they would lose more votes than they gained. And this was probably true. They would probably have lost votes in 1966 if they had promised these changes. Then they brought in these changes, and then the next general election in 1970, they did not say, "We were a wonderful government. We legalised homosexuality. We legalised abortion." No, they didn't talk about it. So this shows that although these were important steps forward, probably Parliament was more progressive than the population. It's always very sad when you see that, but that was probably the case at the time. These laws were more in line with a general tendency of governments in the 20th century to reduce government interest in private life. The idea that your private life is not the government's problem was an idea that was rising. So, for example, a couple of years later, divorce became easier, because the idea that the divorce was not a problem for society, but a problem for the individuals was important. We see this in the vocabulary. I think I may already have mentioned this to you. You know that today we often say one-parent families, des familles monoparentales. In the 1970s, when I was young, did I tell you what the expression that we used? The normal expression, broken home, un foyer brisé. Yeah, he says, suppose that. That was the normal thing to say. Oh, he comes from a broken home. Not, il vient d'une famille monoparentale du tout. So you can see that. Now, if you get the impression that the 1970s was a decade where horrible, disgusting ideas of homophobia and sexism were very, very popular, this is true. I was there. It was absolutely awful. But, you know, there were also people moving in the right direction. Also, 1967, the very first colour televisions. Very expensive. The very first colour televisions. Now, 1967 is a tremendously... Oh, sorry, just first of all, on the sports side, Wimbledon was first, as you can see there, written at the top of the page in Portuguese. Wimbledon, 1967, was the first BBC television programme where you could see Wimbledon live. Now, Wimbledon was easier to film than Match of the Day. Football is more difficult to film. Nothing happens in tennis, it just goes one way or the other, you know. Filming sport was getting easier for another reason. In 1960, the cameras were enormous. So it's very difficult to film, and the cameras are getting smaller and smaller, and so the filming of sport is getting better. But the big change of 1967 Our document today is linked to this. The big change of 1967 is the reorganization of radio. Radio is completely reorganized in 1967. Radio has a number of problems in the 1960s. First of all, the number of televisions is rising. The majority of people have a television now in 1960, oh, certainly 1967, a majority. By 1972, the vast majority of people have a television, and the people who work in radio are very frightened. Now, they think that radio is going to disappear, replaced by television. Now, we know that radio didn't disappear, but they didn't know that radio was not going to disappear. This is one of the terrible things about history. Je dis souvent que après 29 ans des 30 glorieuses, les gens n'étaient pas là à dire, oh, il n'en reste qu'une année. Hein? Eux, ils étaient convaincus que c'était pour toujours. C'est pour ça qu'ils ont mal pris quand ça s'est terminé. OK, so radio people were very worried. Our television is going to replace us. What can we do? And radio was saved by two new inventions. The first one is the invention of the transistor in the 1960s and gradually in the 1960s. And the transistor is very important because it means that in 1950, your radio was like this. And in 1965, your radio was like this. So you could take it to the beach. Well, in England, you don't go to the beach. It just rains all the time. But more importantly, every lorry driver, every taxi driver, many factory workers, shop workers, could listen to the radio because they couldn't go to work with this, but they could go to work with this. You get the picture. So that was the first thing. Miniaturization meant that you could take the radio, usually to work, but also on holiday. The other advantage of the radio is you can do something else at the same time. You don't want your lorry drivers watching television at the same time as they drive, but the radio is okay. And the second big invention which saved radio is stereo music. That is to say, and this is 1967. So peut-être 68, at the end of the 1960s, radio becomes stereo. And so this was important because for many years, the quality of music you could hear on the radio was better than the quality of music you could hear on the television. And so this meant that you know, the radio was saved, but also that radio reorganized itself and music became central. Music is certainly not the only thing on the radio, but music became more important, and this was putting then all of these changes, then the rise of television, was putting BBC Radio under pressure. But the BBC Radio was under pressure for another reason, and this was the return of commercial radio. At this time in the 1960s, the BBC had a monopoly. Nobody else was allowed to broadcast radio in Britain. However, just like in the 1930s, Radio Normandy and Radio Luxembourg had broadcast from France, in the 1960s you had the pirate radios, and they broadcast. What they did is they simply got on ships, there you are, Radio Caroline, and they just took a ship near Britain and they broadcast to Britain. And this was not illegal because they were outside Britain. Yeah, they could do what they want. They invented all-day music radio. Music all day long. The BBC never did this before. They couldn't do it because they had to pay for every minute of records they played. And the pirate radio didn't pay. So we call them pirate radios because they were, one, illegal, and two, on ships. They weren't really real pirates, but pirates, and you know. So Radio Caroline became very, very popular with its new style of disc jockey, very young, very chirpy, very cheerful. Radio London also, another ship. They didn't necessarily treat each other very well. They would try to sink each other's ships from time to time, yeah? It was all good fun. Now, some of you will have seen, I think, the film which was made about this period called Good Morning England. I have to say, it's not a very good film, but you do learn something about pirate radio. So, So in reaction to the increasing competition from commercial radio on the ships and the rise of television, the BBC decided in 1967 to reorganise all its radio. When was the last time they reorganised the radio? Can you remember? Do you remember things I said? Can you remember the last time before 1967 they reorganised all the radio? Anybody? When did they? They invented the three stations: the light program, the home service, and the third program. When did they invent it?
Yeah. 62.
No. Good try. No. Now, when did they bring in the new radio system?
After
yeah, exactly. Yeah, 1945. And in 1945 they were obliged to change things. And I will come back to that later. But so that system with the light program and the third program and the home service lasted from 1945 to 1967, 22 years approximately. And they decided to reorganize everything. And they reorganized everything in the new world of the 1970s. So elitism was still on the decline. It's still elitism, and it's still on the decline. And so they didn't call it the light program anymore. They decided to call it Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3, and Radio 4. Very neutral expression. And Radio 1 was popular music. So they established, under the new system in 1967, they established Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3, and Radio 4. And this is still the system today. This is still the system today. And the division between them is the same today. There are some more today, but I will tell you about those. Radio 1, the latest new popular music. Normally, if you listen to Radio 1, you will get nothing more than 3 years old. Nothing. If you want to hear the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, don't listen to Radio 1. You will get this year's music. Radio 2, any other kind of popular music. Popular music from the last 50 years. And also some more minority tastes in music, yes?
Can you just repeat for Radio 1?
Yes, Radio 1 is the latest new popular music. Nothing more than 3 years old, in general. All-day music, Radio 1 all-day music. Chirpy, young, handsome disc jockeys. This was what they thought was handsome in the 1960s, you know. He's doing his best. Radio 2, then, all other kinds of popular music. Radio 3, classical music and jazz. And a little later, classical music, jazz music, and world music. So world music is like modern music based on traditional African or traditional South American music. Radio 4, intelligent talk. That was the slogan of Radio 4, was intelligent talk. Theatre, comedy, debate, documentary. Radio 4. We will come back to these later when we talk about today. So they decided to reorganise, and this reorganisation gave more space to popular music. Two full channels of popular music, one for today's popular music, one for popular music for the last 50 years. So music was much more at the centre of radio. And this was also, you see, what had happened to, this was also to reply to the competition of the pirate radios. Now, what happened to the pirate radios? Well, the Labour government was not happy with the pirate radios. First of all, the pirate radios did not pay the singers when they played the records. They didn't pay the singers. It was just pirate. And secondly, the Labour government believed in public service. And so they wanted to get rid of the pirate radios. The government wanted to get rid of the pirate radios. This was quite difficult because the pirate radios were extremely popular. And if you start getting rid of things that's extremely popular, that's not easy to do. But finally, they were successful. And in 1965, they passed a law which made it illegal for anybody in Britain to sell anything to the pirate radios, to the ships. And so suddenly, the ships had to get all their food from the Netherlands, all their water from the Netherlands. And so the pirate radio stopped because it was not possible, it was too expensive. However, the government and the BBC, not being stupid, they realise now that the pirate radios are gone, we need the BBC to replace them. And so BBC Radio 1 was based on the same style as the pirate radios, but no advertising. Tony Blackburn, this gentleman here, and many other very popular disc jockeys were employed. They worked for the pirate radios, and when the pirate radios closed down, they were recruited by Radio 1. And they just brought them all in. I think there were 31 new disc jockeys, and 20 of them came from the pirate radios. You know, it was really huge import. Now, Radio 1 was very important, extremely popular. And this was the BBC public service, modern young people's rock and roll channel. Chirpy and cheerful and funny and modern and progressive. And they began with 31 disc jockeys. How many of the 31 do you think were women? Would you like to guess? A couple. Now it's interesting. When I thought about this question and I thought there were 31, I thought, yeah, there were probably only two or three women. That was my opinion. There were zero women, which I think even though we know a lot of that, I find that quite shocking, and I will tell you why in a moment. Here they are. 31 disc jockeys. Just quacky sub to slap. Who launched Radio 1 in 1967, and there were zero women. Now, I found this rather shocking for another reason, because if I tell you that in the 1960s, on the Management Council of the Bank of England, there are zero women, well, we're not very surprised. But the Management Council of the Bank of England is a very, very traditional institution. Radio 1 represented modernity, being young, being rock and roll, being progressive, and there were zero women. So I found that more shocking, in fact. And it showed that, you know, like rock and roll was about, was in some ways, rock and roll was about freedom for men. I don't want to exaggerate, but there was a lot of that in it. You know, it's almost enough to make me a feminist. Oh, it's okay. I'll take some medicine later. I'll be okay. So the disc jockeys. So not obviously a reflection again of the 1970s had great music, but you know, sexism was kind of bad. And here we have Annie Nightingale, one of my heroines. She was the first disc jockey on Radio 1, the first woman, disc jockey on Radio 1 in 1970. I think I already mentioned this in the past for newsreaders, because newsreaders is the person who explains the world to you every night, and if they're all men, that's a heavy message. And in the same way, the disc jockey is the person who tells you how to be young and modern. That's their job. Now, this is in fashion, this is hip. And when they're all men, it's quite a heavy message, I think. In any case, Annie Nightingale managed to get a job with the BBC just by annoying them. She would just go to it's the only thing she wanted to do. And she would just go to Radio 1 every day and annoy them until eventually, like, okay, you can have a show on Sunday. You know? She was just an extremely annoying person and then was happy with that. I don't know if she wrote her autobiography. One of the fascinating things about it is today she is 82 and she is still a disc jockey on Radio 1. You can see if I do show. Which, Radio 1, yeah, the program about today's music. So she does a show about rap and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. Now, it was not easy being the first woman disc jockey, because the management said, oh, you can have a show on Sunday. And she might have thought, oh, well, why Sunday? And you'll never, if I ask you to guess, you will never guess. And what the BBC management said is that during the week on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, our radio is for housewives, for women at home looking after their children or the family. And housewives want to listen to somebody who reminds them of their husband. Yeah. Now, this is stupid but kind of beautiful. This is interesting idea. This was the prejudices of the... It was not based on a study. It was not a study that showed that this was just the prejudice of the management. In reality, daytime radio was listened to by lorry drivers, factory workers, shop workers, street sweepers, and people cleaning the streets have a little transistor to listen to. Yeah, and so the idea that daytime radio was for housewives was not really true. But so she was obliged for several years, she only got a show on Sundays. It's an interesting thing. Now, I hope I'm not giving you the impression that the whole generation were just rather foolish people. I can reassure you that in 50 years' time, people will look at you and say, oh, they were so backward, yeah? Because things are changing. So much for Radio 1. Let's look at Radio 2. And Radio 2 was a very important element of public service in a slightly different way. And that is to say, as I mentioned to you, Radio 2 played, and still today, Radio 2 is the most popular radio station in the country. It plays popular music from the last 50 years. If you're British, there is a terrible moment when you're about 30 years old when you realise you prefer Radio 2 to Radio 1. It's the beginning of the end. Okay, I refuse to talk about my personal case. Okay, Radio 2. Now, Radio 2 also considered that there was another public service, just like with sports. Radio 2 considered that public service was to make programmes about minority interests. One of the difficulties with commercial radio, when it comes, or Radio Caroline, is the advertisers are saying, do you have 10 million listeners? If you don't, why don't you have 10 million listeners? Whereas the public service can say, okay, well, you know, we have these programs, we have 500,000 listeners here, 500,000 listeners there, but we produce programs for minorities, but many minorities make a lot of people. And here is an example. Public service radio does every week 2 hours, perhaps, of folk music. This is English folk music. Now, there's something very bizarre in France that most people in France know that Irish folk music exists. And most people in France know that Scottish folk music exists. But nobody knows anything about English folk music, which is not fair. So this is English folk music. So basically, this first one up here is in 1967, Country Mixed Folk. And this one was every week, Folk on Friday, every week. And today you have... I can't remember his name, but this guy who does every week a folk music show. So, I don't know exactly how many people in Britain like folk music, but it's probably 10% of the population, something like that. It's a minority. So, when they put on the folk show, they probably get 500,000 listeners. But the BBC considered it was public service to make sure if 500,000 people like it, they should find it on the radio. And this is one example of folk music, but there are many, many more. There are, 10 or 15 different musical minorities that you can find on Radio 2. I will just explain one more. For example, I don't know if you... you know of brass band music, the Fanfare de Cuivre. J'ai connu un fanfare de Toulouse qui faisait des versions de chansons punk en fanfare. Ouais, ils avaient fait un disque qui s'appelait God Saves the Cuivre. Je trouve que c'était mignon. Brass band music has its show every week. And here's another example, the organist entertains. 1968 to 50 years every week for 50 years. But this is a minority program. It's about music from this is a theatre organ. It's not the same as a church organ. But it's quite hard to play. You need four hands. Every week, an hour show, the organist entertains four, 500,000 people who like... It's not a majority thing. Yeah, I don't know anybody who likes this music. This is another example of how the BBC considered that public service is making sure that minority tastes are dealt with. Now, this is something we see outside the BBC. For example, the government of London and the government of Paris and the government of Rouen, the local government, gives money to the opera. They give public money to the opera. They know that opera is for a minority, but they consider that it's important to have a variety of minorities. There's more to it than that. Okay, so Radio 2, protecting minority interests. Normally, this kind of program would attract the same people every week. Huh? People who love it and what they would listen to it every week. But it would also attract a certain number of people who were just accidentally listening to it. So Radio 2, Radio 3 then, classical music and jazz. Radio 4, intelligent speech. This is all in a situation where there is still no commercial radio in Britain. The BBC has a monopoly until 1973. So although there is no commercial competition, the reason the BBC is doing all this, reorganising, one of the reasons they are reorganising, Radio 1, the latest popular music, they're reorganising it so that the population do not say to the government, we need commercial radio. Yeah, they want, if the population is satisfied with the BBC, perhaps the population will not be demanding commercial radio. And the BBC would like to avoid commercial radio. They try another experiment in 1967. We're still in 1967. It's a big year, it's 1967. Well, they try an experiment in local radio. Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3 and Radio 4 are national radios. You hear the same thing if you're listening in Manchester or London or Glasgow. And somebody said to them, I wonder if people want local radio. In 1967, it's difficult to know. How can you know if people like local radio? In fact, even if you went into the street and said, would you like a local radio station? People had never seen one. So they might well say, well, I don't know really. What would it be like? And the question, well, I don't know either, but you know, you can't know if people will like it or not. And so they had an experiment for 2 years. The BBC established a series of local radios in big towns. Sheffield was one of them. Leicester was another. Merseyside, Liverpool was another. And they had local radio, so this was a new idea. However, the BBC was the BBC in London. So a lot of the management didn't want local radio. They were obliged to accept it, but the BBC refused to pay for it. They said, "Okay, we can have local BBC radio, but we want the local government to pay." And so, for 2 years, the local government paid in some towns for local radio. Spoiler, it was a success, and today there are 40 local radios, local BBC radios. Why do you think people liked local radio? What are the advantages of local radio? Anybody got an idea? What do you think are the advantages of local radio instead of national radio? You got an idea? Yeah?
Well, you're aware of what's happening in your town, so maybe can get information about the politics of, I don't know, from the mayor or about some exhibitions and stuff like that.
Absolutely. So local politics and local cultural events will be more, because of course on the national radio you can't say, oh, there was a new concert in Sheffield. Yeah? So local information, local news, local cultural news. Any more advantages of local radio? Got an idea? Advantages of local radio?
I would say local news. It's happening in town.
Yes. Apart from local news, any more advantages?
Maybe commercial updates.
There could be, but there's no adverts on the BBC. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe. Might be the beginning of weather forecasts?
It's certainly local weather, absolutely. Local traffic problems. certainly. But we're still on the side of information. Remember that most radio and most television is not about information. But it's important, but it's not the only thing. Well, when people wake up in the morning and they put the radio on for breakfast and they listen to some music and they have a disc jockey, they love the disc jockey to have a local accent. Really, people love it. People in Manchester are very, very happy to have a Manchester voice. And now, I don't know about France, but you can imagine that people in Marseille might be happy to put on the radio in the morning and somebody who sounds Marseille, who has a Marseille accent. Do you think this is possible in France? Do you think it could be difficult to say? Yeah? Does anybody listen to local radio? Does anybody listen to radio? Yeah, okay. In any case, certainly in Britain, this is very important. Remember that regional identity in Britain is very important. In France too, but I know about Britain. And certainly even today, I listen to local radio from my home region, yeah? They speak normal. Yeah? That's how it feels anyway. Okay, so let's see what that looks like today. And you can do this yourself. You can practice your English simply by listening anytime you like to local radio. Let's go for Leeds.
Back to school music, but I was going to tell you about my very dirges today. So,
what? What did I do?
Did you reduce the volume?
I don't think I did.
Greasy food pretty much every day. Oh, it's World Pasta Day today. What do you think the number one pasta in the UK is? I can tell you. I can do your top 10. Up 10! It's fettuccine! I'm not going to do all of them, although that is at 10. Number one, it's spaghetti. You possibly won't be surprised to hear that. But then what's next? Because, like, for me, it's penne. Oh, actually, for everybody else, it's penne. Fusilli, then tagliatelle, macaroni, linguine, gnocchi. I don't think that's pasta, is it? It's like a potatoey sort of pastery dumpling. Anyway, regardless, it's World Pasta Day. It's also Sourest Day. It's a good day to have one of those real sour sweets. Oh, and it's Poultry Day if you feel like giving yourself a Mohican just for the afternoon. You can do that today. Something that I know that a lot of people partake in, and are seemingly quite proud of it. It's crisp sandwich day today.
Okay, so this is obviously humorous, and she's going through. C'est une série de fêtes aujourd'hui. C'est la journée de. Vous avez compris, certains? C'est la journée des pâtes. Yeah? And so she said, what is the most popular pasta in Britain? It was also the day of punk rock. Vous pouvez vous faire un Mohican pour la journée, etc., etc. Yeah, so obviously this is supposed to be for relaxing. It's supposed to be relaxing. You're driving to work, or you're a lorry driver, or you're doing the housework, or you're this is the people. What time is it? It's lunchtime. People might be listening to it in the office because they've got half an hour for lunch. Yeah, so it's very light and relaxing, but that's its objective, and it works better for people who are. Did you notice the Leeds accent? Did you notice an accent? Okay, there you go. I can tell you. They had a Leeds accent, yeah. Okay, so this was a success. It was very exciting at the time for the people who were working in it. It was also on a very low budget, what we call in English a shoestring budget. Despite the hostility of national management, after 2 years, it was a successful pilot. And 20 local stations were announced, funded now from the by the BBC. And today there are 40, and there are 8 million listeners today. Yeah, 8 million listeners today. So let's go back to our thing here. This is 1969, and, sorry, 68, and this is an example of a popular sitcom. Indeed, when they did a survey in 2004, and they asked people, what is the best British sitcom? And this was number four. This one came number four, Dad's Army. It's called Dad's Army. And in fact, it's a story set in the Second World War. Of course, most of the young men joined the army. They didn't have any choice. But the old men, who were too old for the army, they became what was called the Home Guard, which is like a replacement for the police. And in this sitcom, they are old and rather stupid. And they think that they are the stronger military, but actually they're just rather a pathetic old man, and that's the joke. Now, it's not an accident that this is in 1968. Probably in 1946, the war wasn't funny. It's not funny immediately. Yeah, you have to wait, if you wait 50 years, it begins to be funny. So this is mocking old men pretending to be useful to the war. Another sitcom, which I may already have mentioned, The Liver Birds, now there are, in the 1970s, there are 30 or 40 or 50 sitcoms. There's a lot of them. But this one is rather particular. It's about two young women in Liverpool, and they are not married, but they do not live with their parents. You're supposed to be shocked. You're supposed to be shocked. They are not married, and they do not live with them. Okay, you're not shocked. That this was a little bit shocking at the time. Shocking to some people. And so some people said, no, that's good. It's good for young people, young women to be independent and you know, just do their thing and not worry about getting a husband. And other people thought, oh, no, this is really bad. Yeah, society is falling to pieces. And many people thought, well, you know, it's good for women to be independent, but, you know, it's going to be difficult for them to find a husband if they become too independent, yeah? And so this was a perfect subject for a sitcom, because if you want to make a sitcom that has millions of people watching it, you need to choose a subject which is a little bit worrying for people. It mustn't be too worrying or too depressing. Yeah, you can't write a sitcom today about Gaza. It's just not funny. Yeah? But you get something which is people are rather uneasy about, and you get a good sitcom. And there are many, many examples. But this one is exceptional in another way. And that is, it was written by two women. It was written by two women, of course, as you can imagine. Of the 40 or 50 sitcoms in the 1970s, the vast majority were written by men, but this one was written by two women. It's also notable in that the two women are from Liverpool. So the people in London would be amused by the accent, I would think. I have a couple of theme tunes I want to show you here, just to give you a bit of the atmosphere. So first of all, if we go back to Dad's Army, the one about the old men, this is the theme entrance. The cartoon at the beginning, perhaps you notice, is the real history of the beginning of the Second World War, with the British Army eventually moving back to Dunkirk and running away and leaving and coming back many years later. Okay, so the sitcoms. Now, in general, these sitcoms, if people today, I mean, if young people today watch them, if you watch them and you like them, it's more because they're kind of nostalgic and cute. It's difficult comedy for us today. It's too slow. Comedy today is faster. It's like, cause this is really, you know, I'm going to tell a joke. This is the joke. That was the joke. You know, point to your nose. Say, this is my nose. You know, so it doesn't work for us today. But some of them can be quite cute as a sort of either nostalgic or sort of social history look at the comedies of the time. The BBC is continuing, and this is a permanent activity of the BBC, is to find new kinds of programmes. Let's think of something new that people will like. And one of the rises is the cookery programme. There have been many, many varieties of cookery programme. At the moment on today on British TV, there's a wonderful programme called Can't Cook, Won't Cook. And what they do is somebody who knows, supposedly they have a husband or a brother-in-law or a sister-in-law, who never cooks, they phone up the BBC and say, oh, yeah, ask her to come. And so they get somebody who hates cooking and they teach them to cook. So it's funny. Yeah, it's funny and entertaining. But it's also about learning cooking. So it's a little bit... But this is the first ones in the 1970, the Galloping Gourmet. Look, this was... This is what people thought was an attractive man at the time, okay? The Galloping Gourmet. So he's doing something new because, of course, in the 1950s, people who cooked, well, they cooked the same as their mother cooked. And who cooked the same as their grandmother cooked. The idea of, oh, I'd like to learn to cook Italian. I'd like to learn to cook French. It's a very tiny minority in 1950, and this will rise. And so the BBC considered that part of public service was encouraging people to explore in cooking. And so this is the Galloping Gourmet, with a French word, gourmet. And so he would be making French food. And so people would watch it because it's exotic. This is a time when most working class people did not go to restaurants. In the 1970s, my parents went to restaurants for weddings and funerals. That's it. Yeah. And this has changed tremendously. The number of restaurants has gone through the roof. My mother today, she's 90, and she goes to a restaurant every time it's possible to go. Yeah, so things have changed. But it used to be, oh, restaurants, those are for bourgeois people in the 1970s. Oh, yeah, it's really bourgeois to go to a restaurant. Okay, so new kinds of programs, cooking's programs, but that's just one example. There are many, many more. Um, 1969 is also the time of the invention of Monty Python. Now, Monty Python became popular in France much later, in the 1990s. I won't give you my opinion why, because it will sound patronizing. And in France, Monty Python are mostly famous for their films. How many people have seen a Monty Python film? Yeah. Okay. Is it still funny?
Yes,
I know. Yeah, it is kind of still funny, yeah. Which is, now that's quite impressive, because usually comedy from 30 years ago, it's often not funny anymore, yeah. So they did manage to keep something. Now, before the films, they were a television series, a series of sketches for television. I'm hoping I can find one here.
Avec le programme de croissance Royal Canin, offrez à votre show le meilleur départ dans la vie.
Go away. I'm just informative. Not exits.
Good evening, Your Holiness. Good evening, my Command General. I want to have a word with you about this painting of yours, The Last Supper.
Oh, yeah?
I'm not happy with it.
Oh, dear. It took me hours.
Not happy at all.
Is it the jelly you don't like?
Jelly?
I mean, they do add a bit of colour, don't they? Oh, I know what it is. You don't like the kangaroo.
What kangaroo?
Never mind, I'll paint him out.
I never saw a kangaroo.
Well, he's at the back of the llama. Doesn't matter. I'll make him into one of the disciples.
Ah.
Okay?
That's the problem.
What is?
The disciples.
Are they too Jewish? I made Judas the most Jewish.
No, it's just that there are 28 of them.
Too many.
Well, of course it's too many.
Yeah, no, I want to give the impression of a real Last Supper, you know, not just like a last snack or a final meal, but a real mother of the Last Supper.
There were only 12 disciples at the Last Supper.
Well, maybe some of their friends dropped by after dinner for a drink.
No friends.
Waiters?
No waiters.
Cabaret?
No cabaret.
You see, I like the crowd. It helps to flesh out the scene. I could lose a few, I suppose.
Look, there were only 12 disciples.
I'll go. We'll call it the last but one supper.
What?
Well, if there was a last one, there must have been a one before that. So this will be the penultimate supper. The Bible doesn't say how many people were there now, does it?
No.
Well, there you are then.
Well, look. The Last Supper was a significant event in the life of our Lord. The penultimate supper was not, even if they had a mariachi band and a conjurer. Now, I commissioned the Last Supper from you, and the Last Supper I want with 12 disciples and one Christ.
One?
Yes, one. Now, will you tell me what in God's name possessed you to paint this with three Christs in it?
It works, mate.
Works?
Yeah, it looks great. The fat one balances the two skinny ones.
There was only one redeemer.
I know that. We all know that.
I want one
Messiah. What's that? His artistic license.
I want one Messiah.
I tell you what you want. You want a bloody photographer. That's what you bloody well want. Not an artistic creator.
I'll tell you what I want. I want a Last Supper with 12 disciples, one Christ, no steel bands, no trampoline knights, no kangaroos by Thursday lunch, or you don't get paid.
Bloody fat.
I'm out of a fucking Catholic church, I am.
Okay. So, some of the sketches remain extremely popular today. However, there are many of these sketches of Monty Python which have been forgotten, which is fortunate because they did a large number of homophobic sketches and we have forgotten them, which is good. I think it's good to forget them. But from a historical point of view, it's important to remember that this was the atmosphere of the 1970s and there was really some pretty awful homophobic sketches. So, here we are moving into the 1970s. The Open University is starting up its television programmes. Just to remind you that this is a university which allows people who did not go to university, in particular women who are 30 or 40 years old, to get a university diploma by using BBC television, BBC radio, summer schools for a couple of weeks in the countryside, and so on and so forth. Now, by this time, we're now in the 1970s, so we've had 15 years of commercial television. And so the argument continues at this time about, you know, commercial television, public service television. Are they more or less the same? Is public service television much better? And this is a question on which people have different opinions. However, I would say that it depends on the genre of programme. If you want a popular music programme, it could be good on public service television, it could be good on commercial television. However, if you want a documentary series on art or science or history, it's 99% BBC. You know, the commercial television does almost nothing. And here we have another genre, which is the theatre. This is a series which in fact is very similar to Downton Abbey. It's about a big house, the people, the posh people who live upstairs and the servants who live downstairs. Although time has changed and Downton Abbey is much more interested in the lives of the servants. This is the 1970s, the servants were really not very important. Yeah? Now Downton Abbey, does anybody here like Downton Abbey? Yeah, a couple of people, okay. I like Downton Abbey. It's a very conservative series. It was written by a very conservative man, but it's a very intelligent conservative series. But probably Upstairs Downstairs was even more serious. But the reason I put it up here is that this is not the BBC. This is ITV. This is commercial television. And this is one example to show that in some genres, in this case in drama series, you know, quite serious drama series, ITV, the commercial television, could produce powerful pieces. As I mentioned, if you're looking for history documentary series, I know there were about 100 different history documentary series on the BBC, and I asked my Facebook friends last year, can you find me some history documentary series of good quality from British commercial television? And they said, yes, there is one. This one. This is the only good, I mean, quality history documentary series produced by commercial television. It was not, it was too risky. You weren't sure you were going to get millions and millions of viewers. So they did do one, whereas the BBC did so many more, and I will show you some of them next week. Meanwhile, the BBC in the 1970s produced some quite groundbreaking work. This series, I, Claudius, is the story of a Roman Empire, of a Roman Emperor, sorry, Claudius. Have you seen it? What was interesting about it is it was, first of all, it's pretty good theatre, but also you learn things about Roman history. It's not a history documentary at all. It's an exciting story with lots of love and blood. A bit like Game of Thrones, but in the real world. But it also tells you some of Roman history. I, Claudius. Here's another one, a comedy sketch program from 1979, not the 9 o'clock news. And this was quite innovative because, again, this was sketches, you know, 10 or 15 sketches of 2 or 3 minutes each. And what they would do is that they would prepare the whole program, but then they would keep 2 sketches, which they prepared on the day the program was going out. And so occasionally you'd get a sketch which was a joke about today's news, which was quite sharp. And going back to popular music, this new program, which began in 1971, I think, 1971, this new program, which began in 1971, reflected important changes in popular music and also represented a particular program made for a minority by public service television on the BBC, the old grey whistle test. The reason for the title is very complicated and not very interesting. It's a popular music programme, but it is not, we already saw in previous weeks, 2 kinds of popular music programme. First of all, Top of the Box or the 6-5 Special, which is like a party. You can see people dancing and you might feel like you're invited to the party. And also Jukebox Jury, which was a slightly bizarre judgment programme. Notice that for the time being, we do not have in the 1970s programmes like The Voice. And that's a much later thing. So the old grey whistle test is the first programme which takes popular music seriously. They have interviews with well-known singers and bands. And what they will do is every week they will invite a band, and they will say, oh, we want you to play 4 or 5 songs. So they give them some time to show their different work, and they discuss their work. So it is a program which takes, so which is not a party, and which takes popular music seriously as art. Now, this was something new in the 1970s. If you go back a bit, in the 1950s or in the 1940s, popular music singers and popular music writers did not think of themselves as artists. They thought of themselves as entertainers. But after the Beatles and Bob Dylan transformed popular music in the 1960s, some people began to say, yeah, popular music can be art. Now, today, perhaps you remember, Bob Dylan receives the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's now recognised that popular music can be art. And so the old grey whistle test was the first programme which took popular music seriously as art. It lasted for quite a long time, and I think it lasted for 16 years or something, so it was a minority interest, but that's, you know, quite a big minority. At the beginning, it was on Tuesday night at 10:30. Now, if you've written a programme and the BBC says, oh yeah, we'll put your programme on Tuesday night at 10:30, and you say, oh, that's not great news, really. Yeah, everybody has to get up the following morning. But after a couple of years, they put it on Friday night, late on Friday night. And that's much better time for you because, you know, people don't have to get up in the morning. The old grey whistle test was the first time on television for a large number of extremely famous groups from the 1970s. I don't have a list here. But the Britain in the 1970s is kind of interesting because if we got you all to write a list of 50 groups, you know, Britain in the 1970s will be really present. Whereas Portugal in the 1970s, it will be zero. Germany in the 1970s, will be zero. Whereas Britain in the 1970s, you know, Beatles, Rolling Stones, the Kinks, Led Zeppelin, Jethro Tull, quite a lot of people know who they are. You don't have to like them, but it was the decade of British popular music which was the most notable. Going back to sitcoms, I think we might just have time for a short extract from this.
It's almost as much as the train robber's got. Captain Peacock, in acknowledgement of your mission, look at the button. Too late, I've lost him.
Cut off in his moment of glory.
You should just follow him. Quick, yes, even if you have a little crap. Come on. Press the button, Mr. Professor.
Right.
God,
strictly
not.
May I say that this cousin's a great... Where are they?
They've gone down to the basement with your medal.
Stupid.
Just a minute, they're coming back.
Yeah. The comedy is quite slow and therefore not necessarily that funny for today, but I kind of apologise because perhaps you noticed that this gentleman here is a stereotype of a homosexual. And he walks like this, you know, he walks in a very feminine way. This is very 1970s, yeah? Laughing at homosexuals was a national sport. And this was a time when people were not objecting. Indeed, some gay people would say, oh, well, it's good that we have a gay character, even though it's a stereotype. So this was the 1970s. I prefer today. Last couple of examples. This is News Round. This was a new invention because this was the BBC explaining the news for children between 10 and 14. An interesting idea. Not easy. You can understand it. Not easy. Would you like to have to explain the news to 10 to 14-year-olds? Not easy. But quite. It continued for 20 years, so it was quite successful. And this was the BBC said, you know, perhaps there is a demand. Perhaps 10 to 14-year-olds would like to have the news explained to them. Okay. And that's enough chronology for today. Enough chronology for today.